From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Looking forward to next year, the future of the compulsory superannuation contribution that employers pay for their workers will be one of the big debates. The contribution is due to rise next July from 9.5% to 10%, and then to 12% in equal increases over the following 4 years. There is now a fierce debate on whether the increases, already legislated, should go ahead. Some Liberals want the rises abandoned. Labor would fight any such move very hard if the government decided to take that course. The government says it's yet to make a decision, and it would, of course, have to get through the Senate any change in the present legislation. Last week, the government released the report of its inquiry into retirement incomes. It was supposed to be primarily a presentation of the facts, but protagonists on both sides of the debate have found succour in it for their own cases. Today we talk to Brendan Coates from the Grattan Institute, where he is Household Finances Program Director, and to Greg Combey, former Labor Government Minister who chairs Industry Super Australia, the body covering industry funds. Brendan Coates argues against the rises. Greg Combey maintains the increases should go ahead as legislated. We start with Brendan Coates. Brendan Coates, what do you take out of the retirement incomes report to support calling for a halt to the increases?
I think the short answer is that the retirement income review demonstrates that for retirees today, they're actually doing reasonably well. So looking at retirees today, they have lower rates of financial stress, lower rates of poverty, and high reported financial satisfaction and financial comfort than younger Australians. So the system as a whole is working pretty well. That's retirees today. The group that's missing, of course, is renters, and that's something I think we should talk about. But renters who are struggling, they do have higher rates of poverty, and there's going to be more of them in future. When you look forward to retirees in the future, though, and the modelling that's done by the review, and it's worth, I think, distinguishing here between what the government might do in response to the review and what the review in fact is. The review is a very detailed, very careful analysis of what is likely to occur in future in our retirement income system. And the results are pretty compelling. The results suggest that the average Australian single person is likely to end up with a retirement income of about 87% of what they had while they're working, which is above the benchmark that the review uses of 65 to 75%. And that's in line with the kind of international benchmarks you use. Because the trade-off here is between how much income you have in retirement versus how much income you have while you're working. And so compulsory superannuation is about balancing those two things. Compulsory super exists because it helps people to save. They would not save enough without it, which is why we need to have a rate of compulsory super. But the set question becomes, how do you set the rate? And the review's answer, and it's the same answer Grattan has used, is that you set the rate at the level that ensures that the typical person, a median income earner, is as well off in retirement as what they are beforehand. And a rate of about 9.5% actually does that pretty well. Go any higher than that and you're forcing most people to save for a higher living standard retirement than beforehand. And that's something that's hard for them to unwind because that compulsion is effective. And so that's the main reason why we think the rate of compulsory super shouldn't rise, because the review, as consistent with Grattan's work, shows that the system's actually working pretty well. The retirement incomes that people have today and in future are likely to be pretty good, and that raising compulsory super would also actually exacerbate the budgetary costs of an aging population. So if you go from superannuation of 9.5% to 12%, then the tax breaks associated with that, because superannuation is taxed very concessionally, the tax breaks associated with that outweigh the pension savings out for basically 40 years until 2055. And then you've got that accumulated debt to pay back. So there are lots of reasons we think that the review shows that the rate of 9.5% is about the right level, and so we should leave it where it is.
Lots of critics of increasing the level say that, in fact, the money is needed by workers now in their pockets rather than being forced to defer that income. But what is the guarantee in these hard times that employers would in fact pass on that increase?
Well, what we've seen in the evidence is that's what's tended to happen. So you've got, obviously, the Reserve Bank has come out and said that they think something like 80% of the cost of higher compulsory super comes via wages. That's consistent with Grattan's own work. So what we did is we looked at 80,000 enterprise bargaining agreements over the course of the last 25 years, controlling for all the other things that affect wages growth, and basically asked, okay, for enterprise bargaining agreements where super was legislated to rise compared to similar agreements where it didn't, where it didn't rise at other times, what happened to wages growth? And we see that roughly 80% comes from wages of the scheduled increases. So wages growth was lower than otherwise would have been. The review itself has actually added to that evidence base with some work from the Australian National University from Bob Brunig, which essentially shows that something between 70 and 100% of the cost of higher super comes from wages. And these findings are consistent with the international literature as well, that when you have a scheme like super and you do raise those contribution levels, it does tend to come at the cost of wages growth. Now, there's an argument being put forward that, look, since 2014, we haven't seen wages growth and we didn't increase the SG. Therefore, it proves that the SG didn't come at the expense of wages growth. But that's not a really a fair comparison or reasonable comparison. For one, lots of other things happened during that time. The economy, unemployment was higher than it probably should have been. There are concerns about weakened bargaining power amongst workers. These are all things that would affect wages growth to be lower. So you shouldn't just look at what's happened since 2014 and say, well, look, superannuation didn't go up and wages didn't go up. That proves super causes wages, doesn't. There's no trade-off between super and wages. You've got to account for the other things that are actually affecting wages growth along the way. And when you do that, you find a very clear link between the two.
But in present circumstances, one argument is, well, employers cannot afford this increased contribution. So if they can't afford the increased contribution with the fallout of COVID and recession and so on, how can they afford wages growth?
I think the way to think about it is, I don't think that employers pay. I think the evidence is very clear that the workers pay. I think that argument confuses the economic and legal instance of who pays for the contribution. It comes out of the employer's pocket, but it ultimately comes out of workers' wages because they'll increase wages more slowly. Think of it this way. The last few years, firms have not been willing to offer substantial wage rises. Wages growth has been pretty slow. It's been positive. So nominal wages have been rising by something like 2.3% a year. All of a sudden, the government's going to increase compulsory superannuation to 10%. What those that are saying that it won't come at any cost are saying is the firm that was not willing to offer any kind of wages growth beyond that 1.5%, 2% wages growth per year is all of a sudden going to absorb out of their own good graces that extra cost that they have to incur via the compulsory super guarantee going up to 10% and still offer the same wage rise that they did previously. Now, why would a firm do that when they have the ability, as they have in the past, to drop the rate of wages growth so that their total employment cost goes up by the same rate that it was before the SG increase happened?
Now, you speak about the modelling about the future and how people will have adequate income, but we're talking many decades out here, and, of course, models are only as good as the assumptions that you put into them. So how secure can people feel about these projections of future income in retirement?
It's a really good question because the modelling results really do depend on the assumptions. And I think what we've seen in Australia historically is not enough attention paid to what those assumptions are. So when Grattan did our work back in 2018, which preceded the review, we tried to do every sensitivity analysis under the sun to show which things affected the results and which things didn't. And the review has taken that further. So the reason why the review is 640-odd pages is because about 100 of that is just going through all the assumptions that have to be made and which ones matter. And the whole debate actually comes down to an expectation about what retiree spending needs are going to be going forward. Because when you look in the data today, what you find over time is retiree spending declines not only that it stays flat in real terms, as in it only goes up by inflation, it actually falls. They spend less as they get older. And that is driven by the fact that people get older, they become less mobile. The health and other care services they often consume, the government is actually paying for a lot of that, so they're not having to reach into their own pockets. They're spending less on furnishings. They start to spend less on travel. And this is a really clear trend. And it matters because the industry assumptions that are driving the need to go to 12% super are all driven by an assumption that spending needs rise by the rate of wages as people get older. But it basically assumes that a 90-year-old needs to spend 20% more than a 70-year-old. And what we instead show in the data, and the review uses this work as well, as it comes to the same position as Grattan, is that spending declines by about 15%. And so the difference between that 20% increase in spending and that 15% decline in spending is the difference between a compulsory superannuation rate of, say, 9%, 9.5%, and an assumption that you need at least 12 or possibly more going forward. And the evidence so far, so to believe that the SG needs to go to 12, you've really got to be assuming or believing that a 90-year-old needs to spend substantially more than a 70-year-old. When if we all look in our own lives, what they're taking out of their own pockets is often a lot less than what they were the day they retire.
If the contribution doesn't go up, who are the losers in the longer term? You've particularly identified renters as having poverty problems in many cases.
That's right. The trouble is here, so the groups that are struggling in retirement are renters in particular. Those that do retire early are often because physically they can't keep working and the safety net's not very strong for them anymore. And some women, essentially, who are retiring early. Retiring with small balances. Now, the issue is that for most of these groups, high super doesn't solve the problem. Because what super will do, if you compel people to save more through super, is it makes them better off in retirement at the expense of being worse off beforehand. And the trouble is for all those groups, they're often worse off in working life than they are in retirement already. So financial stress is certainly higher amongst renters in retirement than amongst homeowners than in retirement. But financial stress amongst renters in working life is far worse. And so if you force people to save more via super, you'll be taking money off them when they're already in higher rates of financial stress in order to give it back to them in retirement when they are in less financial stress, albeit more than other cohorts. So the answer here can't be higher super. The answer has got to be strengthening the income support system, which is working very well for homeowners. So if you look at the pension rate, the pension is set at roughly the right level. That is a conclusion of the review and of Grattan's own research. The problem is that renters have to pay rent in retirement, which is often 30% of their income, and the rate of rent assistance they get, the income support they get, is not enough. So the problem is that people are in poverty over the course of their lives and financial stress over their lives if they're renters and they're low income. And the solution has got to be something that specifically supports renters in this instance, which is raising rent assistance, perhaps some more social housing as well. It's government that's actually going to come to the party and come to the table and help them. Higher super isn't going to help them.
Often, though, governments won't come to the party adequately.
No, but raising the rate of compulsory super actually makes the problem worse because they're in even more financial stress and poverty before retirement. There's no way around the fact that the big challenge the review showed is that housing is the big problem and the lower rates of home ownership going forward, which means that fewer retirees will own their own homes, more will rent, and therefore many more at risk of financial stress and poverty in retirement.
So what do you think of the proposal of letting people dip into their super to put a deposit on a first house?
I think there are lots of other things that we could do before we went there. But also I think the question about whether you let people do that depends on what happens to the rate of compulsory super. So let's take that one first. So if the rate of compulsory super stays at 9.5%, I think the case for allowing people to access their super for housing is pretty weak because 9.5% is roughly the right level of compulsory super. If the rate of compulsory super goes to 12% as legislated, I think the right answer is not just necessary to let them take out their super for housing, it's to let them take out anything above 9.5% each year. Because you've got a single rate of compulsory super applying to everyone, when replacement rates, so those numbers I was talking about for that 65 to 75% benchmark, vary from much more than 100% for low-income earners. They're already saving for a higher living standard of retirement than what they had beforehand, down to, say, 60% for very, very high-income earners. And so if you are going to raise the rate, you should then give people the ability to cash out anything above that 9.5% and use it for whatever purpose they want during their working life, whether it be a house deposit, whether it be anything else, because there's no need for them to be saving more than 9.5%. And if you did that, there's no question about whether it comes from wages. More broadly, though, for how we should solve housing, look, there are lots of things the government could do. Fixing supply rules, planning rules that affect the supply of housing, changing the tax concessions like negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. These are very politically difficult things to do. Part of our work is on housing, and the challenge there is most of the things that will make a big difference are difficult and therefore not particularly popular, whereas governments have tended, or both stripes have tended, to focus on things that sound good that won't make much difference. And I'd probably put super for housing in that boat. It's one of those things that if you allowed people access to super just for housing, the net effect will probably be prices will rise a little bit. Some more people would manage to purchase a home, but it's not going to reverse the decline in home ownership that we're going to see over the next couple of decades.
And just briefly, what do you think the government will do?
That's a really good question. I think it seems that they're, by flagging that they'll consider this in the May budget, they are clearly considering whether to put a cap on it at 10%. I think if you left it to May, it becomes very difficult to argue. It becomes harder to argue that you shouldn't allow that increase to 10% to go ahead, because it would be very hard to legislate it before the scheduled increases are supposed to start. But I do think that there is that alternative, that if they decide to let the increases go ahead, allowing people to take out at tax time anything above the 9.5% rate, and pay extra tax on it, so it becomes their normal income as part of their tax return, is the compromise solution that we might be looking at.
Brenda Coates, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Combe, when the superannuation scheme was originally drafted under Labor with the scheduled increases, the trade-off was lower wage rises in exchange. In present circumstances, with employers coming off JobKeeper, won't it be even more likely that they'll fund the increases by shaving wage rises?
Look, I think since the period that you mentioned, Michelle, when the super guarantee was initially contemplated, and that goes back to the late 80s, by the way. The guarantee came in the early 90s, of course, but it was part of the accord between the ACTU and Labor in government, and a wage trade-off was part of that original settlement for the first 3% in superannuation contributions. Since then, of course, we've had over a quarter of a century of experience where the super guarantee has risen to 9.5%. And what you've found over that period is there's not a direct correlation between super guarantee rises and wage increases. Yes, of course, there is some correlation between the two, but you can't just definitively say that if you stop an increase in the super guarantee, people will get a wage rise instead. The proponents of saying we've got to stop the super guarantee rising from 9.5% to 12% and that would enable people to get a wage rise, it's really just fanciful. The fact of the matter is that particularly in the current economic environment, people will not get what is already a legislated rise in super. They simply won't get that, and they won't get a wage rise either. That's going to be the experience most people get.
What do you say to the modelling that suggests that future retirement incomes will be adequate at the present level of compulsory super?
Well, we're looking at that very closely, obviously, because really that is the key issue. I mean, the objective of having a compulsory super savings system, as you're noting, is for people to have an adequate income in retirement, and that it sits alongside the age pension and other important forms of voluntary savings, particularly home ownership. So we're looking at that carefully. But already what I can say to you is that if you tweak just one of the assumptions That is the deflator that's used to bring back the future value of super to a present value. You get a very different outcome. You get a lesser replacement wage in retirement. And all of these modelling versions all need to be very carefully looked at, but it is an important discussion. I'm not trying to diminish that finding, but just highlight the fact that slight changes in the assumptions that go into those models can produce a very different outcome. And I'm not satisfied at all that there is grounds in this retirement income review for abandoning what has been a promised increase in the super guarantee to 12% and that has been legislated by the Parliament.
So do you see flaws in the report?
Well, there'll be flaws in modelling. And of course, if you jig with the assumptions, and the actual modelling hasn't been produced by Treasury or Mr. Callaghan's group. They have published a number of the assumptions and scenarios that they've modelled, but modelers will argue about these things. I sort of take a pretty simple view of it all. We've only had a 0.5% increase in the super guarantee since 2002. It's a quarter of a century ago that it was promised to get to 12%. It is really important for people's standard of living in retirement. It's been promised. It's been legislated. It should be proceeded with.
If it's not proceeded with, who will be the long-term losers? What sectors of the population, sections of the population, will lose the most, do you think?
Well, younger people and lower income earners and middle income earners. I mean, the report has some very important findings. One of them is that we've actually got a pretty good system and that it's working quite effectively, and we shouldn't disrupt that. But just as an example, a couple that might be 30 years of age, currently, they're going to miss out, if this increase doesn't go ahead, they're going to miss out on $150,000 to $200,000 by the time they retire. It's a significant amount of money that provides people a lot more financial security in retirement, and that will take the pressure off the age pension in the years ahead. And I don't understand truly why people are opposed to this form of savings for people in retirement. And all that we're being confronted with is an argument to get rid of it, to get rid of an already legislated increase in return for nothing. A vague promise that there might be a pay rise somewhere up ahead. It's all these things always boil down to just taking something off millions of people with no really cogent position as to what they'll get in return.
So what you're saying is, if this rise doesn't go ahead, there won't be a pay rise. There's no trade-off.
Well, we've heard that. Let's go back to the late 90s. Paul Keating had promised to get to a 12% super guarantee. John Howard froze it, deferred it. No compensating pay rises that are discernible anywhere. Fast forward to Tony Abbott's election in 2013. Again, there was a legislated rise to a 12% super guarantee. Tony Abbott pushed it off, till that's what we're debating now, what he pushed off over those 7 years. We've had the slowest wage growth we've had for decades. There's certainly been no compensating wage rise. And we did some specific analysis at Industry Super Australia of 8,000 enterprise agreements to try and find these illusory pay rises in the collective bargaining stream. And of course, you can't decipher it. The truth is that pay rises are influenced by the wage profit share in the economy and the prevailing economic conditions and the way that the industrial relations system is operating. That is the bargaining power that working people may or may not have. And their bargaining power is very weak, the economic conditions are very weak. And you can be certain, I think, that for the majority of the workforce, millions of working Australians, if you stop this super guarantee rise, they will not get a compensating pay increase. They'll just end up with no improved super and no pay rise.
Now, the critics would say that some of those arguing for the compulsory contribution to increase mainly reflecting the vested interests of the industry funds, your funds. Isn't this at least an element?
No, it's not. Look, the industry funds, it's true, are a creature of the labour movement. And as you well recall, I was the leader of the trade union movement. I've been a labour politician. I'm working in the industry fund world now, not out of my self-interest. Yes, I'm well remunerated. But I've always fought for working people, and the people in the leadership of the industry superannuation funds have the same values. You know, we're trying to achieve what is best for the Australian community, and the argument that people like myself are simply in it for our own interest is, well, it's not only insulting, it's really a pretty cheap shot. We're doing what we are doing and advocating what we are advocating in the best interests of the members of the super funds and working people more generally.
If the increase goes ahead, do you think a reasonable compromise would be to allow people to access some of their super for their first home?
No, I don't. And you know, let's not forget the fact that the increase in the super guarantee has been promised to people. It has been legislated by the Australian Parliament, and it's been that case and due to come in now for 7 years, and the first rise of 0.5% is to come on July 1 next year. And for someone on average earnings, that's only about $8 a week. You know, so we need to keep it in perspective. Turning to your question about home ownership, though, it is extremely important for people, as we all know, having access to the housing market. But if we're concerned about housing affordability and trying to lift the level of home ownership in the country, you don't go and cannibalise another part of the retirement income system, the superannuation system. You address the issues of housing supply. You address the issues of housing affordability, and you can take some specific public policy measures for helping first home buyers. You know, that's been a feature of public policy for decades. That's what you've got to do if you want to get more people into home ownership, not cannibalise their savings in superannuation, which are there for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is their retirement income when they do retire. And the purpose of super is to preserve those savings until they do retire, not to have it used for this or that. You know, as soon as you open it up for home ownership, next thing will be HEX fees. You know, then it'll be private health insurance premiums. Then it'll be something else, and it'll eventually get to your weekly supermarket shopping. You know, superannuation's got a purpose, and we need to stick to it.
Just finally, what decision do you expect the government to make next year? And if you think it will decide to try and stop the increase, do you think that you and other supporters of the increase will be able to successfully lobby the Senate crossbench?
Well, the Senate crossbench is, as you know, is a complex group of people, and I wouldn't dare predict anything other than the fact that we'll be doing our level best to persuade them not to take away something that's been legislated for, you know, the many millions of Australian people who are working, and who've got every right to expect this rise in the super guarantee to come through. What I can say is that it'll be a, if the government wants to go down that path of stopping this rise that they have previously promised, it's going to be a fair old fight, I think. And, I've been in a fair few public policy fights over my working life, and I regard this as an extremely important one. And I think it'll be pretty well contested.
Greg Combe, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.